Okay, this is Scientific Apologetics number 10, and we are talking about the criticisms of evolution. And what we're doing is we're starting on page 16 at criticism number 3. So this criticism is very different from the last two that we covered. And just to give you a little structure of what we're going to do tonight, we're going to talk about the fossil record in the first half, and there's a couple criticisms that relate to that, and then towards at the end of the second half, we're going to talk about random mutation in the genome, and then finally, if we have time, we're going to get to the last criticism, which has to do with how God allegedly doesn't fit into the picture of evolution. So we're going to look at that and how to respond to the evolutionists in regards to that. So back to the fossil record, criticism number 3. There are too many gaps in the fossil record for evolution to show any transitional life forms. Fossils from transitional life forms are necessary evidence to prove evolution. If evolution is true, in other words, we should find fossils that show transitions between species. But these fossils, these allegedly transitional fossils, are inadequate in quantity and quality. So when you think about evolution, macroevolution, not micro, macroevolution, and we think about the fossils that we go and dig up, and we've been digging up since Darwin's time, we are struggling to find transitional forms. And so the fossil record that we actually find out there does not look like what we would expect it to look like if evolution was the only process happening. So at every time, and we'll get into this a little bit more detail later, but just stick with me for now, but at every time there is biological innovation, it seems to happen all at once, at the origin of life, or in the origin of these three things. So there's a little typo there. It seems to happen all at once, at the origin of life, or in the origin of bacteria, eukaryotic organisms, and animals. So when we look at the fossil record, we see these bursts of biological innovation. We see these big thrusts forward, if you will, from a primitive life form to a more complex life form in the fossil record. And so this is known as biological innovation. There's a lot of creativity happening all at once in the fossil record. And then we see stages of what's called stasis, which is just basically a kind of a science term for the equilibrium of the species. It's not changing much. And then all of a sudden we see another biological innovation period. And so what we don't see, though, is the transitions between these forms. So we're going to talk about this more, so just stick with me for now. And go down to item E on the next page, top of the page. So evolution doesn't account for these similar bursts of life. And when we're talking about these bursts of life, I'm going to show you what that means. So this is a criticism that is we can lay against the evolutionary theory. We can put that to the evolutionists and say, hey, you've got issues when it comes to the fossil record. You've got some problems. And so how does the evolutionist respond to this when we throw this charge at them? Well, it is not necessary for these transitional life forms to be apparent in the fossil record. That's what they say. They say, well, we don't need to have these transitional forms. It doesn't matter that the fossil record doesn't show them. And they say that we're bound to have gaps in the fossil record due to geologic phenomena. So, for instance, they say that tectonic plates submerge under others. One of the causes of the earthquakes around the Pacific Rim is the submergence of one tectonic plate under the other. That's why we have a lot of earthquakes around California, down to Chile, to New Zealand, up to Japan, up to Alaska, this ring of fire, if you will. And so these tectonic plates, once they're buried, are now engulfed in lava. And as the tectonic plates submerge under the Earth crust, the fossils are lost because they were embedded into the geologic forms, which are now going under another tectonic plate into the, basically under the Earth's crust into the mantle. So then all the fossils are gone. They're lost forever. So this is a response the evolutionists would give to explain away or basically say why the fossils aren't there. They're gone. They've disappeared. And then another thing they like to do is they like to throw this out there, you may think of, why are they talking about this? But they say, our DNA is 99% similar to primates and less similar to less developed species. So they say, we are exactly like an ape or exactly like a gorilla. We're 99% like them, according to our DNA. So they say, don't worry about the fossil record. Look, we have this DNA that helps us see how we are like these more primitive species. And if you look at, say, like a dog, it's kind of like a bear or something, or a horse, in terms of their DNA being similar. So they throw this out there as part of their response. And they also respond in E, they say, this is another type of response, okay? In E, F, we'll talk about this type of response. If the changes in species were not gradual, but came in bursts, spaced out by long periods of time, then more bursts of change, we would expect to see gaps in the fossil record. This is known as punctuated equilibrium. So this is a way they're trying to explain the gaps in the fossil record. So they've developed this idea called punctuated equilibrium. There wouldn't be many transitional forms to find as the transitions occurred quickly and there were less of them. So if you have a species that is not changing a lot and not changing a lot over generations and millennia, and all of a sudden then there's these bursts of change, well, those sudden bursts of change would happen over, say, a few generations. So there would be less of the fossils there for us to go find. And then all of a sudden there's equilibrium again. So there's no change for just generations, thousands of generations, and then all of a sudden within a few generations there's a lot of change. So there's only like three transitionals, if you will. So those three transitionals are hard to find because there's a big Earth and there's little creatures. So we see lots of the generations that are in stasis and we don't see many of the transitional generations because there's only a few of them, so we can't find them. They're too rare. So this is known as punctuated equilibrium. And punctuated equilibrium, in F, then accommodates these fossil record gaps by saying that the species do not evolve but remain in stasis between bursts of change. And the way this, you could look at this, I'll get to your question in just a sec, is on the next page of this little graph. Notice at the top, this concept of phyletic gradualism. Phyletic is just this idea of species. So when you think of phyla, just think of like animal forms, species. And this is kind of like Darwin's tree, if you will. If you look at that, it kind of has got these squiggly lines. This is just an example, conceptually speaking, of Darwin's tree. And we've seen this many times, and we've kind of looked at that last week, what those animals look like on this tree. Now, on the bottom part, it says punctuated equilibrium. So here you have these vertical lines, which are these stasis lines, this equilibrium. And again, that's just generations for centuries and millions of years, animals just are staying the same as they go up this vertical line, as time passes. Notice time is the vertical axis here. And the morphology is kind of like what's happening within, or what's happening amongst this tree. And these are two different trees to help explain the fossil record. So one tree is right, is what they're saying. It's either gradualism, as Darwin put it, which takes this idea that over time things change very slowly. And after an Earth of billions of years old, you eventually get humans. Well, punctuated equilibrium says you start off with this one line at the bottom, and then all of a sudden there's a burst of change. It's a horizontal line and then another vertical line. So I want to kind of spell this out to you. Again, you know, you have this idea of these lines like this, you know, and this is the idea. And you're going to hear this a lot if you're talking to skeptics or atheists. They're going to bring out this idea of punctuated equilibrium. And some of the guys on my team kind of laugh at this punctuated equilibrium theory because they think it's just this, such an ad hoc thing made to fit the evidence. To try to explain why there's no transitional forms. So what happens is the punctuated equilibrium person who holds that view, he says that the reason why you can't find the transitional forms in the fossil record is because there's only like three of them. Because this biological innovation, these vertical lines that stem off these branches, if you will, there's only like, say, three or, you know, a very small amount to, say, thousands here. And so what we go find are the thousands here. We can't find those. There's just not enough. And so these are the bursts of change that are taking place. This is the punctuated equilibrium model. And again, it's a model. It's a theory. So let me get to this question. That's a great question. So there's a Christian perspective to this, an answer to that, and then there's a naturalist perspective, an answer. Now, the naturalist perspective is very inadequate. Our response to their response, which we'll see in a second, is going to say why that what they say causes this is inadequate. The Christian answer is that if this was true, okay, that God caused the biological innovation at different stages amongst the epochs of time. So according to that, this is, say, the beginning of time, and this is where we're at, say, today. And so this is time is passing. You know, we're at 2000 AD, whatever. So... God is causing these at different moments in the past. This is when God intervened at these red dashed marks. And yeah, so this is kind of one of the old earth positions, which we'll get into at the end. Let me get this one first.
So this idea of punctuated equilibrium would apply in the face of Darwin's own concept when he said that, quote, nature takes no sudden leaps.
Yeah, you're stealing that from somewhere, right?
Space war.
Okay. You're not jumping ahead. Just want to make sure. Okay. Yeah, so that is exactly a great point. And this is a response that we're going to give them, which I was alluding to, is that, and we're getting into that right now, actually. But I'm going to comment on that in a second. Yeah. Yeah, so now you're getting into something we're going to get into in about 15 minutes. So you guys are really getting some good stuff. I mean, it's some really bright students here. What's that? Okay. So you guys, I mean, oh man, this is like Rhodes Scholar area right here. Fellows, give you fellowships at universities. Yes. You could put Darwinism at the top, and you could put punctuated equilibrium would be gold. Gold, Stephen Jay Gould, who actually just passed away. He's Gould is an evolutionist. I'm not sure if he's actually Christian or not, but he was one of the leading evolutionist thinkers of the last couple decades, and he wrote some really good stuff. But he just passed away recently. Stephen Jay Gould is the one that. Proposed first this evolutionary punctuated equilibrium model. And you could see him being referenced on the page 17 at the footnote at the bottom, the page before Stephen Jay Gould, and he wrote that book, The Structure of Evolutionary Theory, which came out in 2002. And he was the one that was one of the biggest advocates of this theory. And it was a huge breakthrough, this theory of punctuated equilibrium, because the fossil record had always been a problem for evolutionists or any naturalist. It's always a problem. And it's not just Christians that recognize this. They recognize this too, as we'll see. Okay, so now I explained item G. Item H is something they bring up also as a response. They say the Archaeopteryx, I'm not sure exactly how to say that, but it's a fossil that was found that happened to look like a reptile and bird. Hi. Yeah, it's like a reptile bird creature. Oh my gosh. Okay, I'm sorry, class. These people were making disturbances back there that I could not resist. Okay, so this fossil, Archaeopteryx, I think it's called. There you go. Thank you. I don't speak English very well. It's my third language. So, but this thing was found a long time ago, and it was like this bird-reptile hybrid, if you will. So it was like, this is the transitional. You know, they finally found the one transitional that was to help explain the macroevolution morphing. Okay, they found it. And this is what they bring up as a response. Like, we do have these transitionals. And they bring that up. Now, when you see the Darwin tree, by the way, the Darwin tree is kind of, oh my gosh, that's always does that to me, that one. The Darwin tree is kind of like this, you know, and it, you know, does weird things. Whatever, yeah. This tree, they say, is that these are the transitionals, these kind of lines like this that are kind of not vertical but not horizontal. These are the transitionals on the Darwin tree. And they say that these are the ones that we're having trouble finding. When the tree goes more vertical, when you see the Darwin tree, then, you know, we find those fossils. So so just to give you an idea, these are the missing fossils in the punctuated equilibrium model, and these are the missing fossils in the gradualism model, which is on page 18 if you're just joining us. And this was in last week's folder, which is number 8 and 9 in the back for those who just came in. Let's see. Okay, now, how does the Christian respond to the response of the evolutionist? Well, is this response satisfactory? So are we then, Christians, just going to back down and say, okay, you guys responded, you showed us this punctuated equilibrium model, you pointed to the Archaeopteryx, whatever it's called, and you have a couple different models, so you guys must be right. There must be transitional forms in the geologic structure. No. We say, first, regarding the DNA comment, note that this 99% is not actually accurate, as recent research has shown that it's actually between 85% and 90%. And when you take into account the splitting or the splicing of the DNA, do you remember when we talked about a couple weeks ago? How it goes and it splices the RNA and on human DNA, and it takes different nucleotide sequences and it goes and puts them together, kind of like we do when we cut and paste in Word sentences. That DNA splicing makes human DNA much more complex than the more primitive ape DNA, if you will, or an ape-like creature DNA. And so the complexity even goes... It's much more, there's a huge gap between the ape and the human when you introduce genetic splicing into the picture. And so that 85% then may even be lower. Now, the interesting thing about this DNA is that this comment that they brought up when we're talking about fossils doesn't have any, this DNA stuff they're talking about doesn't have anything to do with fossils or the fossil record or the gaps in the fossil record. It's a red herring argument. This is meant to distract us. This is meant to confuse us or cause us to get all uptight because then we're having to figure out this DNA stuff. So we have to be careful when we're talking about evolution and criticizing evolution. We have to make sure we're staying on topic. This is very important. That's why in this class I've really tried to stay on topic even when questions kind of would be near the topic because there's so much to talk about. And evolutionary theory, like we talked about last time, was a three-part theory. And it's very easy for a piece of evidence that's presented to be put in the, you know, as supporting the wrong component of the theory. So in other words, this DNA thing that they're bringing up, if that's true, they should be bringing that up to support the idea of common descent or universal common descent. They shouldn't be bringing that up to support the random variations component of evolutionary theory or the natural selection component of evolutionary theory. So we have to make sure that we're staying categorized. They say that those who categorize well think well. And so we need to maintain our categories in our mind all the time when we're having these conversations. Now, just to finish this comment on DNA, on the next page, it doesn't have anything to do with the intermediates. That's all I wanted to say about that. So don't take their bait. Don't go there. And on B, fossil records are necessary to illustrate the crucial point of Darwinism. So when they said that the tectonic plates submerge under other tectonic plates and we lose forever the fossils because it's just buried in the lava, well, the problem is that you need evidence when you're supporting, when you're doing scientific and putting together a scientific argument. You need to show evidence for it. And this is the same thing they put our feet to the fire for. They say if you're going to put a theistic claim forward, you need to show evidence. If you're going to say miracles are true, you need to show evidence. You know, if you're going to say Jesus lived, you need to show evidence. If you're going to say God created the world, you need to show evidence. Okay, Mr. Evolutionist, where is your evidence of the transitionals? Where is your evidence of the intermediate fossil forms? Show me the evidence. And they say, well, we can't. It's buried under the earth. The lava destroyed it. Well, I'm sorry, but disappearing evidence is no evidence. You don't have evidence to show for it. I can create a theory right now that says there's an elephant flying in the room, but we all can't see it because it just disappeared. I saw it, but you guys didn't. It went and warped into this parallel universe. It was here for just a second. And you guys didn't turn your heads. It's your fault. So I can bring up anything and just say it disappeared. Disappearing evidence, I can prove any theory is true. So they can't use this argument that it went under the Earth's surface. We can't let them do that. We can't give them that ground. They want to try to use that, but we can't allow that. We have to say, no, I'm sorry. You need to present evidence if you're going to put forward this position. Now, in terms of the Archaeopteryx, I'm going to pronounce it like that, and other mammal-like reptiles that they bring up as example of transitional forms. Well, the first thing we could say is, well, okay, granted that is a transitional form. Let's just grant it's a bird and a reptile hybrid. Well, there's one. That's one piece of evidence that you've got. In fact, you've only got one of those. You don't even have like thousands of that transitional. You only have one. And we have millions and millions of fossils that we've uncovered over the last couple centuries. I mean, museums are full of them. You can't even keep up with it all. Neither can the researchers. They just stick them in a box when they find them and stick them in the warehouse of the museum. And usually they're never researched on any further, even though they should be. Sometimes you get some guy who's trying to get his PhD, he'll go back into the museum warehouse and he'll go dig up some fossil in a box, and you know, it may have something interesting happening there, and he could get his dissertation done because of it. But most of the time, the millions of fossils that we find, we can't keep up with. There's too many out there. So when you have one, and you've got millions that don't show transitions, we have all these vertical lines, but we don't have any of these horizontals or diagonals, then, or we have only one, then there's a problem there. You have one versus millions. So whose point looks a little bit better? Whose theory is more attractive at this point? It's the theory that we only have these vertical lines because there were no transitionals. That theory is more attractive. One versus a million, obviously. And then one last thing on this is that there's another reason for this suspicion of these alleged transitional forms, because there's the Archaeopteryx, but there's also some other stranger-like creatures that they do bring up. Not the half-bird, half-reptile thing, but other ones that they bring up. And so they'll have like one of that or one of that, you know. but they only have one, right? So when you actually look at each individual case that is presented, they all have problems. And I'm not going to get into these problems, but they're kind of called sequence problems, size problems, and time problems. So when they were found, how big it is, and other things. In other words, they sometimes take, say, like a velociraptor-sized dinosaur head and compare it to, say, like a donkey head. And they say, well, this one is like this big, and the donkey head's like this big. And they say, well, the velociraptor, you know, and donkey, I'm just giving you an example. Like, they take the skulls and they try to say that this skull, or let's use a donkey and a horse for example. This horse skull is like this big and the donkey skull is like this big, and say they look alike and they're just, you know, scaled. There's a size issue. And so what's happening here is that you could get a velociraptor head that looks like a horse head, and you could say, see, there's a transition between the dinosaur and the horse or something, because they look alike, but they're just scaled, one's bigger than the other. And so they'll try to present the fact that the velociraptor was like here, and the horse was like here. You know, and you can see that the horse came from the velociraptor. And that's not what they say, I'm just giving you as an example. And they do that. So they put these heads together, these skulls, if you will, and they build this kind of sequence. And they say that because these look alike, they're one's an ancestor of the other. And you can see then the morphology amongst the fossil record, or within the fossil record. But the problem is, there's a size issue. Just because something looks like the other doesn't mean that it came from the other. It just happened to have similar features. But when you actually look at it, the scale is 2 times different. So they try to take a bunch of pieces of evidence and make it fit the Darwin tree, or make it fit the punctuated equilibrium tree. And so what they're doing here then is having theory-related data, meaning that you're taking your theory and you're applying it to the evidence rather than taking the evidence and building a theory off of it, or disproving your theory because of it. And that's exactly what science is not supposed to do. You're not supposed to have theory-laden data. So so that kind of explains that. Now, you had a question.
I wanted you to clarify what was meant by the animal, or excuse me, the mammal-like reptiles. Because I think
Yeah, right. So again, this is another alleged transitional. As they say that there are some reptiles that have mammal-like appearance to them in terms of a fossil. So they look at this fossil and say, hey, it kind of looks like it, even though it's a reptile, it kind of has these mammal-like features. So it's kind of a hybrid between a mammal and a reptile. But again, you only have a few of them compared to millions that we find of reptiles or mammals that are in different categories of life. So again, they're taking these few fossils that appear to be transitionals between a reptile and between a mammal, and they're making it fit this tree. Now, what do we do with these few fossils that look kind of transitional as Christians? How do we respond to that? Well, we just respond saying, well, you're right, it does kind of look like it could be an a transitional, but we have like thousands of this and thousands of that, and we only have 2 of those. So something is weird, must be weird about those. That's one response. So we just say, well, what is wrong with that? Why isn't it like this? Why do we have millions of this and only 2 of those? And another thing to think about is that when you go and dig up these fossils, bones are not always in the right spot. You know, if it's dead, you know, some other animal could go eat on it and then move the bones around or take a few bones away. And so what often happens is that you have a few bones of of the fossil. You don't have all the bones. You have maybe 4. And there is this Java man creature that was undug in like Indonesia like 100 years ago or something. Does anybody remember this from your biology class? Java man. It doesn't have anything to do with coffee. So Java man was like this, they put together this model of what this full skeleton would look like, and the skeleton model was allegedly the transition between a human and a and an ape. And so they said this is the the transitional between human and ape. But the problem was they only found like a portion of the skull and like a portion of, you know, a few other bones there, and they kind of recreated what it could look like according to this Darwinian picture. And when a team of like 30 researchers looked into this, you know, like in the 80s, they all said there's no way that could be considered to be a transitional. So Java Man was just thrown out as a icon of evolution, like we talked about last week. Remember the icons of evolution? Yeah, Jessica.
Like, when I visited the History Museum on the East Coast, and you know, they have like the ape and then all the way to the human, and they have like fossil bones displayed, and
yeah.
They have like what the, I don't know what they're called, the creatures like would look like. Is that yeah. the same thing? Do they only have a few?
Yeah.
They're just saying that this is what it would be?
That's right. Yeah, so typically when you go to these museum shows or fossil shows that they'll have a few real ones, and then they'll recreate the rest. And sometimes, depending on like what kind of part of the world we live in, our facial structure will look different than others. So like, say if you're African American, you usually have a different sort of brow thing happening. Maybe the skull kind of comes out right here a little bit. And they'll say that there's a flatter forehead, and sometimes that happens a lot in with the Asians. There's a flatter kind of forehead sometimes, not all the time. But they say sometimes those shapes look like these shapes that we're finding here. And they're saying, well, this is the response, is that when we see like a flatter skull or a brow, well, we could easily say that well falls within the range of human-like creatures. Maybe even a hominid, or maybe even a human. So to say that is a transitional because it's got a flatter forehead, kind of more like ape-like skull, if you will, that's just, again, making it to fit this model. Because we have humans that have the same skull formation and shape. Yeah, the duck-billed platypus has been brought up as like a transitional sort of a creature living today, but it's not. It's a mammal. I believe it's a mammal. It clearly falls into a species, marsupial? Okay, marsupial. But it clearly falls into that category. Like, there's no question. But it has features of another animal. Now, but the thing is, by saying that something has features or is similar to another, this is called homology when you're talking about evolutionary theory. It doesn't mean that it is a transitional from that species. Like, I have arms and so does an ape, you know? Like, the duck-billed platypus has like a beak or like a duck, I guess, but it looks kind of like a, I don't know, opossum or something, whatever it looks like. So we have to be careful about homology. Similarity does not imply common descent or morphing, macroevolution, just because something's similar. Yeah. So I have a nose, a dog has a nose. So we have to remember that as a response. Okay. let's go to item G. Page 20. Punctuated equilibrium does not appear satisfactory as a response from the evolutionist. If it is an accurate theory, it still removes the gradual transition of animals, which is the core component to Darwinian evolution. This is what Mark brought up a little while ago. The whole idea of punctuated equilibrium takes this whole idea of gradualism and it throws it out. This idea says there is no gradualism, there's just bursts of biological innovation. And so you basically are killing one of the main components of Darwinism, that given enough time, basically anything is possible, given random mutations and natural selection. And secondly, it may align with the neo-Darwinian model, but it is unclear that certain life forms can quickly evolve in a short duration of time. So say this occurs over like 3 generations, or say even 100 generations, you have that. Compared to 1 million generations, it's extremely small. So what is causing all this biological innovation within a minimal amount of generations? Well, it's unclear. And it's also unclear that random mutations can change an animal that much within a few generations, or a minimal amount of generations. This is all very sketchy speculation that an animal can change that much in that short of time. So this is a problem with the punctuated equilibrium model. It's unclear. To answer the question, all you have to do is say, this is a speculation. There's no evidence for that. It's hard to believe that you're going to get this much change in an animal with minimal generations. That's an adequate response. All you have to do is say that that has a lot of problems, because it does. I mean, this is at least believable in an imaginative sense. The Darwinian gradualism, that over enough time you're going to get a lot of change. I mean, okay, yeah, if you've got billions of years, I guess you can have that. But this is getting crazy. This or this? Punctuated equilibrium. Yeah, this is like a few generations, you're getting to another species sort of thing, macroevolution.
But there's no transitional.
Yeah, there's kind of transitionals in here. Yeah, this would be where they say is where the transitionals and intermediates are. Yeah, that's what they're saying. But again, it's an alleged fossil put together with a lot of imagination. Now, they'll bring this stuff up. I mean, there's a lot of secular and paleontologists that are trying to resolve this issue with the Darwinian tree not having adequate fossil support. So there's a lot of research that happens, but it's an extreme problem. Now, let me just explain. Let's just continue and finish this point. What is very clear is what all paleontologists find in the fossil record, a stasis of life. This is that equilibrium of species that we talked about. This is what all paleontologists find, a stability in the biological forms over time. That is, animal fossils remain stable. Okay, then I got a lot of quotes here. Now, these quotes, interesting enough, are great, but there's none more interesting than the quotes I have from Darwin himself. So if you look at K, Charles Darwin said, even at back then in 1850 to say 1880 when he died, he said sometime during then, not one change of species into another is on record. We cannot prove that a single species has been changed. Charles Darwin. Now look at L. The number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed on Earth must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. So he is easily admitting and telling everybody that there's a real problem with the fossil record and my theory. Scientific observations and my theory don't match. Darwin readily admitted that. And then the other quote right there is exact repeat of the quote before. I guess I got excited and pasted it there. I definitely didn't retype it. Yeah, I definitely didn't retype it, but I must have copied and pasted it. So the third Darwin quote in N, Charles Darwin, nature may almost be said to have guarded against the frequent discovery of her transitional or linking forms, meaning that nature seems to be holding back these transitionals. They must be there somewhere. They're just not found yet. They're just not found yet. Nature is holding back its transitionals. That's what he thought. And then other people have said, the fossil record has always been a problem. As is well known, most fossil species appear instantaneously in the fossil record. So most people readily acknowledge that there's big instantaneous eruption of species out of nowhere with no intermediates between them and the species before. This is a really, really big problem. I want to emphasize how big of a problem this is for macroevolutionists. It's the fossil record. And this is, fits really well for the Christian who's trying to lay against the evolutionist view. Now, we're almost coming upon a break here, and they didn't appear to print out my handout that I asked them to do. You don't have like a chart, do you, in your the 10th note, say in the back of the 10th outline? There's no big chart, is there? No. Okay. That's all right. So the next criticism that we have here, criticism number 4 and 5, have to do with the fossil record. The fossil record, we've already talked about, there's no transitionals, but the other criticism has to do with the Cambrian explosion. Has anybody heard of this? Cambrian explosion? Okay, so the Cambrian explosion challenges the traditional idea of gradual transition of animals because all of these new life forms appear at roughly the same time. The 10 million year period is basically equal to 10 minutes out of the 24-hour period. And this is so short that it is below the resolution of the fossil record. And this is brought up by Jonathan Wells, meaning that if you're on a football field, in terms of time, say your timeline here, and you get to the Cambrian explosion, you're getting all of this life, say this is a football field, from here to here, okay? And you're getting all this life, like, right within there, okay? This is a huge burst of biological innovation within, like, say, 1 yard of a 100-yard football field. So in a minuscule amount of time, it's even shorter than that. It's like the size of, you know, 1 foot on a 100-yard football field. It's a very, very small amount of time as this Cambrian explosion. And the Cambrian, that word just refers to this time period way back when, about 550 million years ago. Now, the 550 million years ago doesn't really work if you're a young Earth creationist in here. And I'm sorry, I'm not proposing an old Earth model to you right now or a young Earth model. I'm remaining neutral till the end of the class. But and then if you pay me $5, I'll tell you what I am. But I want to just tell you that if you think the Earth is very old, then you would also have this notion of the Cambrian era in terms of fossils and geologic strata. And the Cambrian explosion is 550 million years ago. Now, the Cambrian explosion is about either 2 million years long or about 10 million years long. So very short in terms of an Earth being 4 billion years old. Okay, 2 million years compared to 4 billion is minuscule. Now, page 23, the Cambrian animals are shallow sea creatures, and the Cambrian explosion is estimated to have occurred about 530 million years ago. And again, see, it's a short duration. And the more we realize, the more research is conducted in D there, the more we realize that the Cambrian explosion time period is shorter and shorter than once thought. So this is becoming very clear how short this explosion of life really is. In F, these creatures can be best seen in the very well-preserved Cambrian fossils that were found in the Burgess Shale of British Columbia. This is above Seattle, on the way to Alaska. Kind of on the cliffs going up the coast there. And these were found 150 years ago, so Darwin actually knew about this. And these shallow sea creatures are now extinct. So we see all of their fossils in the shale that is on the coast of British Columbia on the way up to Alaska. We see all of these animals up there very well preserved in that shale formation. And then again, we also see this in China. And Chinese researchers are looking into this as well. And again, there's a lot of Chinese skeptics about Darwinism. There's a lot of people in China that really are skeptical about Darwinism, not like we are here where we think it's just fact. Let's see, now H, these are soft-bodied creatures, and it was once thought that these soft-bodied animals were too soft to be preserved. In other words, they're kind of like, they don't have a lot of bones to them, if you will, so it's hard to say that we could ever go find a Cambrian animal, but that's not true. We definitely can find them, and we did. We found them in China and in British Columbia. So again, there is no clear gradual development with the Cambrian fossils as there are too many. So all of a sudden, in the Cambrian explosion, we have this massive biological innovation happening in a short amount of time. Now, what does that sound like to you? What is that, when you have that kind of data, what view does that intuitively support?
Aliens.
They came, they dropped off the stuff. Yeah, they threw up on us. And you get the Cambrian explosion. What view does that readily support? Yeah, some sort of outside innovator coming in and creating something quickly. So you saw the tree of gradualism, but really, when you think about the Cambrian explosion, you have a lot of this happening. You have a lot of, instead of a tree, you kind of have a lawn. This is grass I'm drawing. Okay, this is kind of what we find when we go look at the shale in Canada and in China. We have all these creatures, and we have no idea where they came from. There's no branch, there's no root, like in the tree of Darwinism. You don't have any of that. You have a lawn of all these little weird creatures, and they're very strange, by the way. They're very alien-like. And you have this all over the world, actually. We found this not just there, but other places too. And so you don't have a tree, you have a lawn when it comes to the Cambrian explosion. And so how does the evolutionist respond to that? In order to figure out how they respond to that, we're going to skip down to their response on page 25 for the sake of time. Let's see. Oh, by the way, 150 years after Darwin, the evidence is still lacking of the transitionals between the era before this and them. So there's all these sort of life forms that we found like this, very, very primitive life forms. And then all of a sudden, the Cambrian explosion of very, very complicated life forms, comparatively speaking. I mean, the biological, the every structure, the skeleton structure, it's all very different from what's here. I mean, extremely different. It's like a human compared to like a, I don't know, like a cockroach or something. It's extremely more complicated here than here. Now, in item two down there, response by the evolutionist, about halfway down your page, the fossil record, this is how they respond to this Cambrian explosion. The fossil record is incomplete and too damaged to provide us with a complete picture. So time will give us a better record is kind of their idea. It's like, well, it's incomplete now, but eventually it'll become more complete. And the fossils that we have, they're damaged, so we really can't put them together really well. We have to kind of make believe and create these artwork sculptures of skeleton formations. So they say it's too incomplete, it's too damaged, and so it doesn't support your theory, but it would support ours given a better fossil. And they also say this poor record does not include any transitional forms. So they readily admit that, especially when talking about the Cambrian explosion. They totally admit this. But we find that this response is unsatisfactory because, one, even the soft-bodied creatures are well-preserved, so we can go see that these and other soft-bodied creatures in the era before are well-preserved, and they don't look anything like the other. So just because they're soft doesn't mean they're not well-preserved. And the worldwide Cambrian fossil record corresponds from continent to continent and is, in fact, fully framed out. So we have enough fossils to see that there is, in fact, no transitionals below the Cambrian era. We have plenty of fossils. Each fossil category of the Cambrian period includes newer finds in China and other continents. So we're continually proving this over and over and over again. The Cambrian era was really an explosion of biological innovation. Overall, their response simply fails, and they have no explanation of the Cambrian explosion. So that's not in your notes, but just to summarize and conclude, overall, they don't have an explanation, so they really don't have a response. Their response just fails when we bring up the Cambrian explosion and how to show how these things got here. They have a very inadequate response, and I don't really have other things to... I'm not building a straw man argument here. They really just don't have a good response for this. And they readily admit that this is a problem. So Now, there has been, I skipped over it, but a leading secular proponent of evolutionism on page 24, his name is Simon Conway Morris. It's in item L on page 24. Dawkins, in his debates, often refers to Simon Conway Morris when he's trying to reference another scientist other than himself to prove his point. So in item L, he says, "My main conclusion is that the Cambrian explosion is a real event. The massive burst of diversification we see in the Cambrian itself is a real event." So this isn't something that Christians or ID theorists are making up. We're not making up this Cambrian era in the fossil record or the geological structures. We're not making up the fact that there's all these different weird species that just appeared suddenly that are extremely more complicated to the primitive, simple-celled sort of species before. It's something that even he will readily admit, and he's saying those words like that because other scientists try to attempt to speculate that there's problems with this, that they never really happened. But over and over and over again, this is confirmed that there was an era at 530 million years ago that had these fossils, and there was no fossils anywhere close to them before. And this guy is trying to say, yes, that is actually true, and we as evolutionists don't have a response. Yes, sir. Yeah. So this is Cambrian. I would say that everything before is kind of a more complicated form of like a bacteria or a, like I said, extremely primitive sort of species. So here you're getting biological structures like a sponge, for instance, but with legs walking around with eyes on the seafloor, that kind of a weird creature. Or a creature that would go and hover above the seafloor and flap fins and go eat other smaller Cambrian animals. So you have species that have full digestive systems, ways to move around, walking or swimming in this sort of Cambrian explosion. And here you have things that are extremely primitive, that have no biological structure at all like that. So you're talking like kind of plant-ish, plant-like creatures almost, that dumbed down, if you will. So there's extreme innovation happening here. And the name of this period before the Cambrian I was going to give you this, but the name of that was the Ediacaran period. The Ediacaran. So sometimes this is called the Ediacaran biota, and this is the Cambrian biota, which is just a bunch of species that were found. And before that, you really have kind of the beginning of everything, like the first cell. If you're gonna be the evolutionist, it's before the Ediacaran era. You have the prebiotic soup, essentially, if you're the evolutionist. But before that, if you're a Christian, you would say, this is getting towards the end of the class, so I'd rather not comment further on that, how the Christian makes sense of all this. Yes, sir. And then we'll take a break. Go ahead.
So, like, you're saying that the pre-Cambrian stuff, is that, I mean, were you kind of meaning that they're like single-cell stuff, or they're like multi-cell?
Yeah, so under the Ediacaran, a bunch of, if you're the evolutionist, you would say there's a bunch of single-celled or multi-celled primitive life forms. You know, bacterias that are a little bit more complicated. Okay, let's take a quick break, come back in 5 minutes, and then we'll get into a completely different thing. like 1 minute, but you know, we should sit down and chat more, because I've chatted with these guys here and there, not a lot, but here and there, but I want to learn more about you. Okay, everybody, if you're in the kitchen, come back in. Oh, hey, Mark, were you going to say something? If you didn't get a chance to get up, I think there's some good snacks back there. Thanks to Mark Shrimp. And
they're
Cambrian Shrimp. From, thank you, Maya. Hi, Maya. And she's got some other food to share. Okay. There's Cambrian Shrimp back there. Oh, man, we've been recording the break, too. Okay, that's fine. Hey, Maya, is there a red dot at the top of that screen right there? Okay, cool. Okay, let's do this. Now, if you have your 10th outline in front of you, please open that up. We're on page 1 of the 10th outline, which is found on the left-hand corner of that table by Rachel Petty. So please get a 10th outline if you can, and turn to page 1. So we're talking about criticism number 5, and again, this is a Cambrian explosion criticism that we're presenting, and I'm not going to talk about it, so turn to page 2. So, but I'm telling you, there's another criticism. So there's a whole criticism and response and another response on page 1 and 2 of this outline. I left it brief on purpose, but we're going to go ahead and go to criticism number 6, because this is a very important criticism. And this is a newer criticism, if you will, of evolution. Now, remember that evolution has three components. It has a component natural selection, it has a component random variation, and it has a component of universal common descent. And this criticism has to do with this random variation component. Okay, so again, we got to categorize. Remember our categories. So we're criticizing the random variation component of evolution. Now, recall that evolutionary theory states that random variations gives material for natural selection to operate on. Okay, remember that was one of the main claims of evolutionary theory, that random variations gives material for natural selection to operate on. Now, allegedly, this gives rise to the beneficial features of life as generations reproduce. In other words, when it's said that in the theory that as time passes and generations reproduce, the random variations in the DNA will provide a beneficial mutation eventually, and over time, natural selection will act on that, and that beneficial mutation will maintain through the future generations. Okay, but now we have the capability to investigate which changes in DNA could result in beneficial mutations. This endeavor was supposed to help us understand which mutations provide a competitive survival advantage in a given species. Recently, The scientific research has shown that 99% of molecular changes in DNA are actually destructive at the biochemical level. These negative changes do not provide genetic enhancements and beneficial features in species. Thus, the random mutation component of evolutionary theory is contradicted by the evidence. Okay, so all of that says, and we're going to kind of hash it out, is that when you have a random variation in the genome, in the DNA strand, in the nucleotide sequence, if you remember us looking at the DNA double helix shape and the nucleotides and the sequencing of them, and we talked about how that's information in the cell, when you have a random variation in that, when it's copied to the next generation, the evolutionary model again says that eventually you're going to get a beneficial mutation for that species, for that survival environment. And the beneficial mutation will continue in the species that continue to reproduce, and the negative mutations will cause the species to not adapt to that environment, and thus they'll die out faster and become extinct. And those that have beneficial mutations will survive and live the longest. So the question is, does the random variation actually do give beneficial mutations? Or does it give neutral ones or negative ones? That's the issue. Now, I'm trying to summarize all this because I really spelled it out here in the outline, but and you could go back and read through it. But if you turn with me to page 3, now you don't have to worry about skipping stuff because I'm giving it all to you verbally. You could go back and read it thoroughly if you want. But there are types of DNA mutations when you go from one generation to the other. There's a substitution type, a deletion type, an insertion type, a duplication type, a transversion type. Now, all you need to know about that is just that when DNA changes as it's passed on from generation to generation, it goes through these certain types of changes, and you can categorize these types of changes this way. Now, interestingly, the sickle cell, you may have heard of that, it has to do with malaria, is a random mutation in the DNA sequence. We can see that two copies of the sickle cell will kill the child who's 10 years old of sickle cell disease. But one copy of the sickle cell will protect against malaria. So interestingly, you have this random variation happening in the genome, and when you have this thing called the sickle cell, one of them will help prevent malaria, but two of them will kill the child of sickle cell disease. So based on just how many of these things happen, is good or bad? Now, that is a really interesting thing, so just hold on to that for a little bit. So what's taking place there is that you have these random changes in the genome, and a good effect could come of it and a bad effect. Okay? Now just hang on to that for a sec. Now skip with me. Next page. The results on item 9 there at the top. The results of the years of research into malaria show that random mutations are reductive and damaging to the functioning features coded for the human genome. So over time, as we've researched malaria, we've seen that random mutations are reductive and damaging, so they have negative effects for the species going forward, not beneficial effects. Okay? And this is characteristic of the human genome. Item 10. This is incoherent breakage of genes by random mutations. So when the gene or the cell is passed on, you have an incoherent breakage of genes by random mutations, and, quote, it makes changes in genes that help no matter whether the changes add up to any system or not. Okay, so again, we have a helpful sickle cell that helps prevent malaria, and then all of a sudden, one more of those things, we have something that kills the child. So you have a random variation that just is changing and changing and changing, and there's no reason, it's not getting better, in other words. It's causing problems. It's killing the child. So it's incoherent. It's an incoherent breakage of the genes. The gene itself is being degraded, and it's becoming more harmful to the human. 11, this does not show a process that would cause the development of the organism with integrated complexity in the cell, and increasing beneficial features. So in other words, you're not getting greater complexity here. You're not getting any survival advantage here. You're getting something that causes more problems. You're getting negative consequences. Now, before we move on, let me take this. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, so just essentially that if you have one cell in your body, that's just one. And then if you have two, you have two. I think that's what they're talking about when the sickle cell.
The genes for sickle cell.
Correct, yes.
Okay, because I thought maybe you meant the alleles, so that you get one allele from your father or your mother.
Yeah, I think it's, and that's having to do with the alleles and the chromosomes, and so then you have that, but those come from the DNA sequence. So yeah, it's all again goes back to, can be traced back to the DNA, the sequence of the nucleotides, and then that informs the other cells or all the cells. It's a little tricky though when you're talking about when you actually put it all together to explain it biologically. And I can't do the full explanation here. I just don't have that background. But it's just one copy and two copies. That's all you need to know in terms of what causes sickle cell disease or prevents malaria. But I don't have the background to elaborate on it too much further, unfortunately. So now if you go to down to item 13 there, now we're talking about malaria. We're talking about sickle cell disease. What else? What else could we do to show, or what else could we see in nature that shows that random variations in the genome do not produce beneficial or helpful effects? Can we expand this in the form of a lab experiment? So humans and other animals do not generate fast enough to determine if our genes cause beneficial mutations upon which natural selection can act. So in other words, you can't put a bunch of humans in a lab and have them just reproduce and then find out, like, you know, in the matter of a couple years of research, how these random variations help or don't help humans. It takes too long. Yeah, thank you so much for asking. A generation time is less than one day with bacteria. So with bacteria, these things reproduce like rabbits, if you will. They reproduce in less than a day. So we can study the variation in thousands of generations of bacteria to see if they evolve. And how do they maybe morph into a better, sort of more complex organism. So if we had a lab experiment, it would really help show this. And it turns out that we do. We have a lab experiment. In item 17 there, this experiment was performed in a 30-year lab experiment by Richard Lenski, distinguished professor at Michigan State University, not a Christian school, obviously. He published his results in 2007 in the highly respected scientific journal Nature. Now, he has produced 40,000 generations of bacteria with a population size of 100 trillion. So there's quite a few. And the results of this 30-year lab experiment show four bad gene and DNA effects. And these are the bad effects. There's lost ability to make a component of RNA, deleted genes responsible for metabolism, damaged ability to repair DNA, and lost ability to metabolize sugar maltose. So all involve the loss of genetic information or protein function. So the result of a 30-year lab experiment showing that generations upon generations of bacteria allegedly morphing show that it actually caused damage and destruction to the genome, not enhancement. And there was no beneficial features that were added to the species. So you don't get positive morphing, if you will, or greater complexity. They saw evolution of bacteria caused genes for ribose to be deleted, destroyed, and or thrown out. Okay, and you could skip there a little bit to the next page at the top 23. In conclusion, even the beneficial mutations we see, were about 1%. incoherent mutations, no theme among mutations, scattered mutations in different genes, no process of building a new system in the cell, and only reproduced more rapidly. So you have all of these problems, even in a alleged beneficial mutation, okay, in this 1%. Now, a quote by Michael Behe, because he's talking about this in his new book and also in that article that I referenced below, he says that the incoherent breaking of genes by random mutation shows the pitiful limits of the ability of unguided processes to fashion life. So when we see this in the lab, what we're trying to do with this lab experiment is we're trying to show, originally it was trying to show that random variations in the genes of when you have a bunch of bacteria together could cause beneficial mutations over time. And after 30 years and 100 trillion bacteria, we don't see any beneficial mutations. We don't see any greater complexity. So if you have a big prebiotic soup, if you will, on the early Earth surface, and you've got 100 trillion bacteria in this little pond, you're not going to get a greater sort of species, a greater complexity to the bacteria at all. And you're actually going to get a bacteria that is degraded and tending towards destruction. That's what you're going to get. So this was a kind of trying to model an alleged prebiotic soup, if you will, and show that if we just try an example to see over a lot of time, 30 years and 40,000 generations, I believe it was, can we get greater complexity? And the answer is no, you actually get a damaged species or damaged molecule. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, so when you talk about malaria, when you go back to malaria, and you compare that malaria situation with the sickle cell with this, it's the same thing. And then if you look at an HIV virus, so it's a different kind of life. So bacteria is one thing, a virus is another. You get the same sort of thing. And so in the three, at the bottom there, in 27, in the three different fundamental forms of life, we have the same effects of the Darwinian mechanism, negative effects in the eukaryotes, which is the malaria example, and the virus for a virus, which was experimented when looking at HIV, and the prokaryotes, E. coli, for instance, you have the same problem. You have a negative effects after generation after generation. Now, you could say that this is a direct observation of what Darwinian evolution does, you can say not do instead of do not, does not do what we theorize it does do. So this is direct evidence. So oftentimes we think, okay, in a prebiotic soup with a bunch of simple sort of molecules and bacteria and all these other chemicals and creatures, if you just give it enough time, you're going to get greater and greater complexity because of the random variations in the genome, you know, in generation upon generation. But when we actually do an experiment to model that, and we give it tons of time, tons of generations, we're not getting what we think we're getting, according to Darwinian evolution. So we have here direct evidence that random mutations do not provide beneficial features. And it's interesting that you have the same thing happening in creatures today. We don't see creatures just becoming greater and greater as time passes. So response from the Darwinists is this. They say the 1% of the mutations are beneficial to the organism. See, we do have 1%. See, that's enough. With 1% over time, we can get some greater, some enhancements. And then they say drug resistance is a clear indicator of beneficial mutations. Now, how do we respond to that response? We can say that even the 1% were degrading in nature with losses in ability. So when you look at the 1% of allegedly beneficial features in those bacteria that we're generating, we could say that there is no indication that they were on their way to building new complex systems. And even the beneficial mutations break genes and degrade functions like a bowl in a china shop. And then in a large volume of tries, the effects are minor, mostly degrading, and no new complex systems like the molecular machinery that fill the cell. So with all of these generations, you don't get a cell out of this. You don't get some awesome cell that has all these molecular machines. Even with that 1%, you still have a breaking down of the genome. And it happens to have a beneficial mutation like resisting malaria. So interestingly, you have that one sickle cell when you're talking about the genome, and that is a random variation. And it just so happens to resist malaria. Two of them, again, will kill the child. So you have this bowl in the china shop sort of thing happening with these random variations. It's just incoherent. It's just chaotic. And there's no system. There's no process to it. It's random, and there's no goal in mind. It's undirected, which they say that is what it is. And but at the end of the day, you don't have any enhancement to the genome, any greater complexity. You have a degrading to the genome. And it just so happened, accidentally, that resists malaria. So that doesn't, but it doesn't imply that this is getting more complex and it's getting more beneficial and there are enhancements. And that's the point. So just because something happens to resist malaria accidentally does not imply that it's getting more complex. And that is the whole component of the random mutations, the random mutation component in the evolutionary theory. So this is hard evidence, and down there in C, that random mutations are incoherent and degrade a genome. There is no evidence it can build the molecular machinery that fills the cell, and we no longer have to imagine what random mutations can do. We now know what they do. Even the positively selected beneficial random mutations are degrading. Even the ones that have accidental positive effects, it still is a degrading that there's still a degrading that happens. And so that's all we'll say about that. But this is another interesting criticism that has just came out in 2007 to the evolutionary theory. It is new, and Behe wrote about it in his new book, Limits of Evolution, or no, The Edge of Evolution. That's his newest book. So in 1996, he had that groundbreaking book, Darwin's Black Box, which was heavily criticized, which we talked about last week. And his newer book, I think it came out around 2007, 2008, he references this experiment a lot, and he discusses it in great biochemical detail. And but this is kind of the summary of that. And so Behe's done a lot of great work there, showing how this component has its problems in evolutionary theory. There's no hard evidence that supports random variations producing a more complex molecule or organism. Any questions on that? That was a little technical, a little fun, a little weird. Don't typically like to talk about bacteria and malaria, but I guess you squeeze it in your life one day, huh?
Is there any response to this experiment?
Just the couple I mentioned. That's all I know of. Yeah. Now, if you turn to page 13, because we're going to skip criticism number 7 like we skipped criticism number 5. Criticism number 7 is kind of similar to how I criticized naturalism at the beginning of this course, and it's a little different. It talks about how evolutionary theory can generate religious belief in general. They basically are saying that because we evolved, we have a strange tendency to believe that God exists. The tendency is in our genes. It's part of our natural makeup, and it came because in our primitive life forms, our primitive ancestors basically had a desire for unity in their communities, in their populations. Say there's a primitive group of hominids or something. And in order for them to stay together, to resist predators, they would have to create a reason why they should be united. And because disunity was happening all the time in these early communities. And so they created this religious kind of cult and formed this idea that there's a God, and it helped in their worship to this God. It helped them have a unity together, and it helped them establish rules for that community and regulations and punishments. And if those who went against the community were to be punished, and those who went along, stayed in line with the community, you know, reproduced more often or something. And so over time, you have this idea that those who were religious or in line with the religious belief would produce, and those who wouldn't would get kind of scattered and outside of the unity of that community, and they would be left open to predators in the wild, if you will, and they died out. So those that survived and went on, who had a survival advantage, if you're in talking evolutionary theory, those who went on and continued to reproduce, and that's how we got here today. We're descendants of ancestors who basically had that religious belief because it helped them survive. And so our responses to that is, well, I don't want to get into it because we're not talking about it, but our response is that, well, let's say that's true. Let's just grant that whole story. It's basically saying that religious belief is a good thing. It helps people survive, okay, number one. Number two, we agree that religious belief is an innate idea. If you recall, we talked about innatism at the beginning of the class. That's this idea that we have these beliefs that are inside of us, that we have at birth, if you will, that have nothing to do with our experiences in the world and our doing experiments or interacting with others. It's just these ideas that are there, ingrained in us because we're humans, because we're just born with these ideas. And we actually can say that, okay, well, we agree that a religious or belief in God is an innate idea because we are creatures designed with a hole in our heart for God. And so we affirm the idea that we're born with this need, this desire, this drive towards this creator of us. And so we agree on that account too with this whole story you just told. But another response we could say is that there's no reason why this story that you're proposing is true. There's no evidence for your story, by the way. So thank you for sharing this beautiful story, this description of anthropology and such, but I can't talk to you seriously unless you provide evidence, and you have not done so, but I appreciate the story. I feel like falling asleep because it was a nice bedtime tale. So that's another response we can give. So quickly, that was criticism number 5, 7 and its responses. So the last criticism of evolution. Oh, yes, question.
Oh, I'm sorry, but also doesn't that go against what you said about them saying, or maybe it's just the naturalists, but then us firing random, what was that about?
Random neurons firing our head back and forth. Yeah. No, what they would, that's a really good question. What they would say is that this is a byproduct. This religious belief, it had its benefit in resisting predators and becoming united as a community. It had that benefit, but it happened to be just a random byproduct of these random variations over generations. It's like one day somebody had a variation in their genome structure that lent itself to this idea that if we propose a God and build a community, we can survive longer together. So they say that random byproduct, that it was just a, you know, innocent sort of thing that just popped up into one of these hominid creatures' minds, helped them survive. So they call that a spandrel. So it's just this kind of accidental effect. And it happened to be a natural effect of a supernatural, causing a supernatural belief. So it still was a naturally caused a religious belief. And the belief was helpful for survival. Now, the last criticism, which we don't have time for, So I'll let you guys go, but let me go ahead and go through it first. No, I'm just kidding. This I could summarize for you, and we've kind of talked about it when we went through the naturalism criticisms at the beginning of the class. This idea has to do with, and I'll just summarize it for you here in a few minutes, is, let's just read it. The evolutionist implication of the Darwinian mechanism is that God is not real, as we have an alternative explanation of life's origination and development. Now, this criticism number 8, has to do with that. And this is the deal. Even if Darwinian mechanism exists, this does not replace the agent. Now, this is very important, and we kind of talked about this before. But even if you have a mechanism, you do not necessarily throw out the agent. Now, the agent could have caused the mechanism, designed the mechanism, whatever. But an agent is a cause in a way that a mechanism isn't. So let's take, for example, a car. If I'm starting the car is going to turn on. If I give it to Ryan and he helps me with it, the car will turn on. And so it takes someone who knows what they're doing, who has an understanding of the mechanism to make the mechanism work in advance. So Henry Ford, do you remember we talked about him? He was the designer of the car engine and of the assembly line. And so when we look at the car engine, we have this awesome mechanism there. We have this beautiful machine. But just because we have a mechanism and machine, it doesn't mean that we just get rid of this idea of a designer or of a mechanic that could come in and make the thing better. So that's the idea with this, is that atheists love science because they think that science shows that you don't need an agent because you can explain everything through natural causes. So atheists, this class is like perfect for the atheist to pounce on because atheism is, or science is his pot of gold, if you will. It's his treasure. It's what makes his belief system have a foundation. And the reason is because they think natural explanations of our world and our universe, our behavior, help us get rid of the need for God. So as long as I can continue to explain everything with natural statements, then I don't need God. The problem with that is that just because you can explain stuff in nature doesn't mean that you get rid of the agent who caused or designed the nature, and it doesn't mean that that agent doesn't exist. Now, this is the idea. Let's see. Okay, we'll just kind of finish, get the last thought out on this. Let's just read D on page 15, and then we'll close this up. So John Lennox is a great mathematician and philosopher in the UK, and he's the one that really puts forward this criticism in response to people like Dawkins. He actually did a debate with Dawkins, and Dawkins brought this up, that you once you can explain the mechanism, you don't need the agent. Well, Lennox responds, just because you can explain the mechanism doesn't mean you throw out the agent. And he says, Lennox goes on to say that just as the words Henry Ford couldn't be written in purely scientific description of the laws of internal combustion, so we wouldn't expect God to be written in a purely scientific description of a scientific law or mechanism. But this does not imply that Henry Ford did not exist, neither does it imply that God doesn't exist. So just because you can write out something that doesn't, in naturally speaking, doesn't mean that you can write out God or can get rid of God, if you will. So, in other words, you can't just throw out God because you don't need to reference God in your explanation. Okay? And intelligent design says that Can you explain everything with purely natural causes alone, or do you need, or does design need to be involved in that explanation at all, in any way, shape, and form? And if design needs to be involved in that explanation, then you have to have an intelligent designer. You don't have to explain it, but you still have an agent, the need for an agent. And they go on to say other strange things, like God is more complicated, he's too complicated, so we can't include him in our naturalist account of things because he's this complicated entity, and we need to have only simplistic explanations. And obviously the response is just because something is allegedly complicated doesn't mean that it's not there. And so they kind of go off on this rabbit trail where they say, well, how do you explain God then? That's another response that Dawkins would give. So say we say, okay, well, you can't get rid of the agent. He says, well, who made the agent? Well, the whole idea with God is that he's an unmade being. He's an uncreated creator. He's the unmoved mover, as Aristotle put it. And so God, by definition, is uncreated and does not need an explanation. So that's another response to their further response. And again, this actually happens. I'm summarizing an actual debate between Richard Dawkins and John Lennox on this very topic. So this gets brought up all the time. Question?
They contradict themselves because they'll go from there is no God to God's complicated, so, and we don't know how to explain it. And it's like, you just said there's no God. The next step is he's just too complicated, so he's not in the picture. So you can tell it's like a heart issue at that point,
Yeah, there's like this need. They say we don't need a God, so therefore he must not exist. It's like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't follow. Just because you don't need a God in your explanation doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So yeah, there's definitely a hard issue. They say, well, he's too complicated if he's real, so we don't like him, you know. It's like, well, that's your fault. Now, last, page 17, to conclude, all of this topic, all this stuff about evolution, the conclusion to the validity of evolutionary theory is that it seems that Darwinian evolution has its issues and the responses from evolutionists are lacking. So it's problematic, to say the least. It does not account for all the appropriate features of life and the origin of life. It does not adequately account for the Cambrian explosion. Therefore, evolution is insufficient as a robust or holistic theory. So just to summarize all these criticisms, there's your conclusion there. And then to conclude, finally, this whole idea, this whole topic of biochemistry and biology, the theory of evolution has problems that show it's unsatisfactory. And based on the evidence of specified complexity and irreducible complexity in the cell, we can logically infer design. So I'm ending it there. And maybe after, so people don't kill me because they're so mad that it's 9 o'clock. Okay, so if you have any questions, please come talk to me after it's over. And say hi to this lovely lady right here who happens to be the founder and president and CEO of Christian Speed Match. Christian Speed Match, everyone. She's with us tonight. So I say hi to her. Okay, dear Lord Jesus, thank you so much for this time and learning about why evolution has a lot of problems. And thank you for helping us keep our categories straight and think clearly, even this late on a Thursday night. We pray that you'd help us this week and weekend as we move closer to Easter, prepare our hearts and minds more to understand you better and this world better. In Jesus' name, amen.